Welcome, and welcome to USD again, and welcome to San Diego if you're not from our area. And this weather, if you are from our area, you know this is the beginning of May. May gray and June gloom, 2 months of a year in which we do not have our sun, except as if on purpose trying to demonstrate that I lie, the sun is coming out. But anyway, most of a year we have the best weather on the planet, but for 2 months we are a poor imitation of Chicago. So anyway, that having been said, my thanks to Sarah for inviting me to set the theological stage as we start our meeting. Living next to the most crossed border in the world, with over 70 million crossings per year, it is impossible to ignore the realities of binationality, of the often cruel artificiality of borders, and of migrations in both directions. People forget that there are thousands of U.S. citizens living on the Mexican side because they cannot afford to live in San Diego County. And they work here, or they work there, and so on. So this border is an imaginary line that can be very cruel. So more on this a bit later. I know that all of us, well, you, will visit one side of that imaginary line we call the border, so I won't describe it for you. You'll see it tomorrow morning. Unfortunately, you will not see that same imaginary line from the other side, where they have planted crosses for each of those killed by the Border Patrol in incidents that are always blamed on the victims. So rape is the fault of the victim. The number of crosses increases every year, and there is no sign of it's going to be stopped anytime soon. My intent is not to speak on what Christian doctrine might or might not say about immigration. If you don't know by now, you need to go back to school. Rather, I hope to raise some questions this afternoon on what immigration might say about the meaning and consequences of Christian doctrine. So the opposite direction. Instead of what doctrine can say about immigration, what can immigration say about doctrine? Okay? In my view, the border and immigration are important dogmatic issues in the strict theological sense of that term. We always think pastorally, and indeed we have to. But if we stop there, we miss the greatest of all challenges. The questions, I hope, might prove important for those of us who engage in the scholarly study of Christianity and its doctrines, and those of us engaged in ministry and other social services. Who is Christian might turn out to be more important than what is Christian, at least for debates on immigration. I suspect that some of the questions might be uncomfortable, but in the world of higher education, at least, we cannot afford to pretend that uncomfortable issues do not exist. I also hope that these reflections and questions will help set the stage for the following 2 days of discussions on the mutually implicating relationship among or in between theology, immigration, and the border reality. Now, truth in advertising. I'm a theologian. I'm not a social scientist. More specifically, I do systematic theology. I do not do social ethics. My interest on immigration is focused on the inescapable challenge posed by immigration to the usual doctrinal, theological, pastoral, and institutional meaning of church. I should also add that for me, to reflect on immigration is not a theoretical exercise or a reflection on someone else's experience. I am an immigrant who arrived in the U.S. as a kid, and who has never forgotten the experiences of uprootedness and discrimination that most immigrants, their parents, and their children can still identify as their own. My life is implicated in my own remarks. Now, For a well-written and very disturbing story of immigration, I suggest you read Enrique's Journey by Sonia Nazario. If you can go to bed easily after reading it, you haven't read it. Go back. For theological studies on immigration, check out the works of Carmen Nanco Fernandez, in Bible, Jean-Pierre Fries and Danny, Daisy Machado, Fernando Segovia, also in Bible, and so many others, myself included, because Latino theologians, biblical scholars, and historians have been seriously reflecting on immigration for at least two decades. For us, this is reality. We're dealing with it day in and day out. Not irrelevant to the debates regarding immigration is the fact that at least 65% of the U.S. population identifies or self-identifies as Christian. Whether they attend church or not is not the point. The point is that they self-identify as Christian. Okay? Why? Why should U.S., as a consequence, why should U.S. Christians and churches, as well as U.S. scholars of Christianity, reflect on immigration? Why should they take the experience of immigration very seriously? Because 65% of all in the U.S. self-identify as Christian. So even if you're an atheist, it is a heck of a population. In any society, 65% is big. So there are a number of very important reasons to study immigration. But let me briefly mention three. I have a limited number of minutes, so I have to limit myself. The first reason to take immigration seriously. Nearly half of all Catholics in the U.S. are Latinos. About 15% of all American Episcopalians are Latinos. About 25% of all United Methodists are Latinos. Close to a third of the membership of U.S. Pentecostal denominations are Latinos, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We're here. We ain't going away. In case you hadn't noticed, we're here and we ain't going away. And Latinos are already the second largest ethnic group in the country after European descendants. And in some states, will soon become the populational majority, already surpassing, as in California, European Americans among those under 35. The future is ours, regardless of whether someone likes it or not. The future is ours. Latinos are younger and have larger families than any other ethnic or racial group in the country. Although the majority of Latinos are not immigrants, beware of stereotypes, the majority of us are not immigrants, millions of us are immigrants or the children of immigrants. And therefore, immigration is never far from our families and our communities. All of us are implicated in immigration. But immigration is not a Latino issue, period. Consider also the millions, and I mean millions, of Filipino, Vietnamese, African, Canadian, Pacific Islander, and European immigrants in the U.S. today and their children. Immigration is not the experience of one group or of one generation. Not if you're the child of immigrants. U.S. Christianity remains as strongly as it was in the 19th century, a religion of immigrants. So please ask yourselves, how can we honestly and ethically do American Christian ministry or American Christian theology and disregard the most traumatic experience in the life of millions of members of the American Christian churches? How can we do American Christian anything and ignore the reality of millions of immigrant Christians in this country? And for those of us who are Catholic, and this paying at least lip service to this institution. For example, half of the members of our own church are immigrants or descendants, immediate descendants of immigrants. How can we be Catholic and ignore the immigrant population? Second reason to take immigration seriously. The Christian theological tradition has often spoken of the church as a pilgrim people, a people on the move. These images, however, are not just poetic phrases. They indicate a reality that lies at the very foundations of Christianity. They remind us of some crucial consequences of Jesus' preaching on the reign of God. They point to Christianity's approach to an understanding of reality and to its experience of God. Or to put it differently, it is impossible to be a Christian and to be stuck in the past or in the present. The pilgrim people of God, because they're pilgrims, are living witness to the precarious and always penultimate reality, quality of all human societies, of all human explanations, of all human institutions, of all human decisions, and of all human expectations, and of all human churches. Only God is final and absolute. Indeed, it is part of the genius of Christianity to value that which is truly human while at the same time critiquing its claim to finality. Only God is final and absolute, and nothing and no one can make such claims, and this includes the churches, their leaders, their institutions, all theologians, and every human decision. This double genius of Christianity has pushed it forward in spite of its own follies and sins. The image of a pilgrim people, therefore, is not just a poetic phrase, but a doctrinal insight that touches the very core, the very dogmatic core of who we are as a Christian people. We are pilgrims into the future reign of God, and therefore of the very essence, and it is part of the very essence of Christian identity and practice to be immigrants. How can we be on a pilgrimage into the reign of God without ever moving? How can we be a people stuck in the past? How can a people move into the future without somehow becoming immigrants into that very future? How can we do theology or ministry without somehow reflecting on the meaning of migrating, even if only from the known to the unknown? Can we be Christian without ourselves becoming immigrants into the future of humankind? Can we speak seriously and responsibly about the future fulfillment of the reign of God without realizing that it requires our migrating into the future and thus our becoming immigrants in and to the reign of God? No one can hope to participate in the reign of God without first admitting that he or she is an immigrant into that reign, because no one has a birthright to the reign. No one has a birth certificate to the reign of God. Before God or God's reign, we are all and only immigrants. These are not poetic or homiletic phrases. To a systematic theologian, these are very explicit dogmatic statements in the strictest sense of the term dogmatic. These terms have very explicitly to do with the very definition of what it means to be Christian, what it means to be church. Theological reflection on immigration, therefore, is not just about those who have crossed borders and their children. It is not just for those who are pastorally engaged with immigrants and their families, or for those who study them as objects for the furthering of dominant knowledge. Theological reflection on immigration is perhaps the most unsettling and most prophetic contribution that we in the trade of theology can make today. theological reflection on immigration must be part and parcel of what all Christian theologies and institutions do, because being pilgrim, being immigrant toward the reign of God, is a necessary, indispensable, non-negotiable and foundational reality of the Church of Christ. Therefore, can we understand ourselves as church without incorporating immigration into that understanding? Of course not, unless we adulterate Christianity. Can institutions that claim to be Christian be therefore Christian if they do not institutionally incorporate immigration into their daily mission and reality? Of course not, unless they adulterate Christianity. This is so not because of political correctness or because of momentary convenience or importance, but because this is of the very essence of Christianity. Third reason to take immigration seriously. All Christians claim that only God is God. All Christians claim that only God is absolute. Christians are not into idolatry. We claim to oppose it. Good. Kiss yourself. If we debate the issue of immigration as immigration is usually understood today, it's because another decision preceded it. The decision to establish, recognize, and enforce a border. Without borders, there'd be no immigration as we understand it today. Any border, our local border, the one with Canada that people forget, I'd like to see the same stuff happening up north, and every other border between nations anywhere else is an imaginary creation. God's earth did not evolve with borders. Human decisions made a few rivers and a few mountains into borders. Human decisions. Human decisions, as in our local case, made an imaginary line into a border. That is yours, this is ours. That's a border established by human decisions. But more precisely, borders are established by decisions made not by humans, but by a handful of humans who have the power to make those decisions and to claim the authority to defend the decisions and to have the authority to be obeyed in enforcing those decisions. Established borders are the result of power decisions by the dominant. Thinking as Christians, what do we do with human power decisions that are the cause, and we can prove this on this border, the cause of thousands of human deaths? How many deaths are too many for American Christians to say somebody is sacrificing humans on the altar of the powerful? Human beings are being killed, hunted, persecuted, separated from their children, in prison, traded as merchandise, and at times treated as slaves or animals because of earlier human decisions that decided that an imaginary line called a border had to be established, defended, and protected, and that is patriotic. You're a bad American if you don't support the border, regardless of the idolatrous consequences, or if we were in Arizona, we would know some of the ores already. We should all start wearing armbands saying, "I'm Latino." Reminds us of a certain country and place that we saw or we thought would never be repeated. Adolf is laughing at us. Are the human decisions that created and still maintain the borders absolute decisions? Are these decisions so extraordinarily necessary or absolute that human lives can be sacrificed to maintain the borders created by a handful of powerful humans? To defend borders born of conquest, must we continue to sacrifice humans? And I remind you, the U.S. did to Mexico what Iran did to Kuwait. Who, may I ask, can claim who, may I ask, can claim that human politicians can make decisions that not even God made? Decisions that are blatantly against the most basic of God's commandments, that violate the very image of God, who's humans, not borders. Human persons, the living images of God, endowed by the Creator with a dignity that no human law can give or take away, are persecuted because they have dared cross an imaginary line established by politicians through the use of force and solely for the purpose of furthering their human interests. Have we Christians endowed a human decision by human politicians with an absolute character that can only be claimed by and for God? Can one be a Christian and not see the transparently clear idolatry in much of today's debate regarding immigration? Or do we think that some idols are okay as long as they benefit us? This is not politics, what I'm talking about. This is basic Christianity 101. This has to do with a Christian response to the gospel of Jesus Christ. This is basic Christianity, where idolatry is not acceptable. And idolatry is to claim to recognize the quality of absoluteness in what is no more than a temporary, limited, and penultimate human creation. To put a human law or a human decision above real respect for shared humanity is not acceptable to Christians, and even less acceptable when adherence to a human political decision requires the infliction of death or suffering on other human persons. I cannot think that what I have just said is doctrinally or ethically irrelevant for Christians. And so, that we not commit idolatry, that we be immigrants into the reign of God, and thereby that we affirm immigration as an indispensable component of the church's identity and reality. All my three questions to you, I think, are non-negotiable questions. But how do we let these very foundational doctrines and questions shape the mission and daily reality of Christian communities and institutions today? I suggest that always including the immigrant, because without the immigrant in every discussion, there is no real inclusion of immigration. Immigration is a theory without the immigrant. The how, nevertheless, cannot be answered exclusively by those who benefit from the existence of borders. The answers also depend on the immigrants themselves. If being a pilgrim, being an immigrant, is of the essence of Christianity, then the inclusion of immigrants and their experience cannot be taken as secondary, as cosmetic, or as an excuse for one more committee or statement for institutional marketing purposes, or to make us feel good as we continue doing and being what we have always done and been. So to conclude, have I set the stage, Sarah? We can either pretend that we haven't seen or heard, especially after you visit the border tomorrow, or we can pretend that what we have seen and heard doesn't apply to us, to our theologies, or to our institutions, for whatever reason. Or we can pretend that it is possible to be Christian while ignoring the crucially essential dimensions of Christian self-identity. Or we can think that we are already doing everything that needs to be done, thereby absolving ourselves of any further change. Fortunately for Christians, things like the Arizona law continue to happen, so we're never done. I sometimes tell my students, I am fighting today almost for the same things I was fighting for 30 years ago. You know, it's like, come on, Providence, do something. And it has. It has created a new generation of fighters. We can honestly wrestle with the issues, with the call of the gospel and with the real lives of immigrant women and men with their children and the real future of our churches, knowing that there are no easy answers, but questions that we cannot avoid and facts that demand our attention and fights that need to be fought. I don't know the answers to all of my questions, maybe to any of them. I have a few ideas of where we might go. But that's why we're here, to figure out what can one more group of people with a conscience do. Not just talk about, do. And some of us do what I am doing. Very politely, suggesting that we move our derrieres. I hope to have helped us begin to confront or continue to confront some of the consequences that millions of our fellow Christians bring to our door. I know it's not easy to deal with immigration, but as Christians, we have no choice. The meeting we are beginning will continue raising questions and challenging our answers. So, thank you for asking me to set the stage. Now let's move on to the stage. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Professor Espin. I come from a congregation that really feels it's committed to overturning idolatry. And I think the way that you have set the stage is exactly how it needs to be set. And I've not heard it presented that way before. And in spite of their commitment to overturning idolatry, we have been so constrained by the other frame. So you set the stage, but the stage that we're commonly, that we're more comfortable on is the stage of borders, where we have not examined them as being penultimate, but of being, well, of course there are borders. So one of my members asked me after a discussion, well, we can't just have open borders, which has become this kind of, you know, horrible consequence of any movement in the other direction. My point, however, is how do we address this issue as you have done today? And by doing so, do you not also take on the responsibility of addressing the fear that people have of losing the benefits of idolatry? Because that's what it means. At the same time you bring to consciousness all that you have, I think there's a responsibility to bring to consciousness the fear that may yet be unspoken on behalf of so many folks of what it means to live without those benefits.
I always start from the premise that most people in our congregations are decent. That they're always the characters, the weirdos, and so on. Welcome to an extended family.
Yes.
We all have the weird uncle. But most people in a congregation, in any congregation, are decent people. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. But at least they want to be good, they want to be decent, they want to do what's right. Okay, you live, that's it. So one has to build on that sense of, you know, I don't want to be bad. Okay, I don't want to do bad to others. Okay, so one has to build on that. Secondly, I would need to ask a bit more about the specific congregation. What sort of congregation is it? Is it white, black, mixed race, Latino, Asian Pacific? I mean, what kind of congregation? Because that makes for all kinds of possibilities in what I could answer. Mm-hmm. That would make any sense to you, that it's not just one more theory up here that you can read in a book.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it doesn't make as much difference as you might suppose. It happens to be a predominantly Anglo congregation, but I think those who oppose what we are advocating come from all categories. And because what you suggest is so profound, most people are willing to be generous out of their surplus. But what you're talking about reaches deep down to the fundamental benefits of every American citizen that is bought at the price of this idolatry. And so when you start raising these questions, you're talking something really deep that they feel threatens the well-being of their families, not just what can I give out of my surplus.
Let me give you two bits of an answer. You're a minister, from what I just heard, and you can tie the tongue the dots. One is that sometimes fear might be the idol. And so sometimes we have to deal with the fears. And any pastoral counselor knows that oftentimes fear becomes the idol, the paralyzing idol. And the thing is to help people overcome their fears. I'm an immigrant. I have two doctorates. I'm a university professor. What do they have to fear of me? So it's fear is making them not see the reality. Are most immigrants like me? I came into this country with the clothes on my back and $1. As they would say en français, c'est tout. Eso es todo. And I think I've done well. And I can give you an enormous list of people who have come into this country with nothing but themselves. And they have done well. Why? Because themselves was the big value. Themselves was their big wealth. When people start seeing that when we talk immigration, we're talking immigrants. So who are the immigrants? That's how I start my talk. Who are the immigrants? All of a sudden, you have to kind of get them, their fear, their idol, to deal with reality. Mm-hmm. Are they to be feared? It's all the stuff that the people who created the borders, because they're the ones who have the money to go on television and pay those ads, are those really factual, those ads, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So one first suggestion is fear might be the idol, and the best way to confront the idol is to confront reality. See if the real immigrants, the old ladies, the parents who come so that they can earn some money so they can feed their children and so on, is that reason to fear, wrap ourselves in the flag and oh my God, the country is coming to an end? You know, I do remind you as an African American that in the 1940s and 50s, it was not about us, it was about those that looked like you, the world was going to change, the earth was going to collapse if you were all thought to be our equal. One of you is president of the U.S., Where's Armageddon?
You saw that earthquake in Iceland.
So,
volcano eruption.
In quite country. But it also happened in Haiti, so yeah. Anyway, that's the first point. The second point is, you said they think they can give out of their excess.
It's a very liberal congregation.
Remember the little story that Jesus told in the, well, it was not a story, it was presented by the synoptics and John. It's the only miracle of Jesus that is presented in all four Gospels, if my memory doesn't fail me. I'm not a biblical scholar, but as a theologian, I should know the Bible. And it's the multiplication of the loaves and fish and Jesus telling the disciples, feed this crowd. They answer as very reasonable, decent people. We ain't got the means. There's not going to be enough for them and for us. We only have these few things here. Five fish or whatever it is, or five loaves. It seems that Jesus didn't pay attention or went in one ear and out the other or something. He keeps insisting. and they keep saying, hello, Jesus, repeat after us, 2 + 2 = 4. There are thousands of them here. There won't be enough. Come on, guys, feed them. We can, can't you? Feed them. So back and forth, back and forth. Until finally, either they get tired, or they all of a sudden get the faith that they didn't know they had, or they decided to get loony, and start sharing from what they know it's not going to work. And that's the miracle. The miracle is not that Jesus multiplied the loaves and the fish. The miracle is that they came to believe that if they shared, God would take care of the rest. God did. That's the miracle. So it's not, wow, Jesus, you're so powerful. No, it's like, oh my God, he's crazy, but it worked. And they were telling him, you are not looking at reality. And he kept saying, maybe you aren't looking at reality. God is part of reality, at least for Christians. So, you know, you might want to one Sunday preach on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, often have.
Yes, sir.
Orlando, I work on the fact that you talked at the beginning of your presentation that migration is a two-way reality. It's not only people coming from the south up north, but also moving from the north down south. And a couple of days ago, we were in a presentation, a lecture in Long Beach, and I was sharing with the people there that the way I see the reality of migration nowadays, I'm the director of a center in San Isidro, so we are 3 minutes away from the border. And it has been a migration of necessity in which the fear should be looking to the realities of privilege. And the migration of necessity becomes a reality forced by me because I want to live, you know, pretty comfortable in San Diego, but I wanna, you know, good prices on the goods, you know, that I want to enjoy. Though, so then my Latin American brothers and sisters and so many others around the world are exploited just to maintain my lifestyle. So, and then the policies of my country is forcing my brothers and sisters from the south to move by need up north looking for some opportunities. But as part of our center, then we provide an experience of a group of us going into the center of Mexico. So the group can see then the other type of migration, which is what I call the migration of convenience.
San Miguel de Allende.
That's the place where we go. San Miguel de Allende, that provides the reality of a small Mexican town with 30% of the population being American retirees, owning 85% of the businesses, changing the whole phenomenon, the economic phenomenon in Guanajuato. And I believe that that's something that many folks on this side of the border either don't know about or doesn't want to know about, realizing that many of us are also moving. The difference that I see, and this is my point, is how those that have nothing welcome us in their land, in their midst, provide for nothing they have, everything they have with us, and how restrained we are in this world of privilege in welcoming the stranger, which for me, coming from the Caribbean, from a very crazy migrant reality, being Puerto Rican, not knowing who I am because, you know, I am but I'm not, the easy way of getting into this country, and how hard for me it is, even for Latino, to sometimes, you know, welcome my brother and sister because I have lived also as part of the privilege. And I wanted you to see, I wanted you to talk a little bit more about, you know, the theological perspective of that privilege versus necessity kind of a thing. Because when I look into the Bible, I see a God, you know, a God that believes in migration. I mean, the Bible start talking, you know, in Genesis with the Spirit, you know, moving with no borders.
Abraham.
Jesus being, you know, dislocated and moving. And then at the end of the book, I found a man that is in exile, in an island, away from home. So for me, the best book about migration and immigration is the scripture, and I wanted to see, you know, what your opinion is.
Well, I'm not going to disagree with the Bible. I might interpret it differently, but I might not. I think that it is very important for anyone doing ministry or theology to consider migrations, as I mentioned. But it would be very naive to consider migrations, immigrations in all directions, if we don't do an analysis, a connection with power asymmetries. If we forget that there is such a thing in the reality of this planet called power, and I mean, we are really believing in Santa Claus, with all due respect. We were having a conversation about Santa Claus before we started, for other reasons. So it's really to believe in Santa Claus, to think that because one says, oh, one has to respect the rights of all human beings, that therefore that will convince, you know, everyone. Hello, we have been hearing that from time immemorial, and here we are still discussing it. Thing is that very often we have not paid attention to how issue A or issue B, and I can think of immigration, ethnic bigotry, racial bigotry, gender bigotry, LGBT bigotry, or bigotry against, etc., etc. I mean, multiply, all right? How all of these play is as if we're dealing with this issue, or that issue, or that issue. Why are there groups marginalized? They didn't self-marginalize, they were marginalized. Why? Why do we live in a world that does this? Why do we live in a world that thinks that because someone is a little darker on the outside that somehow there's a difference? Why do we live in a world where if you don't have a little something and you're a woman, you therefore are not? Come on. Why do we have to be demeaning of other people? Why do we always have to be thinking of winners and losers? What is there in reality that makes us not function sororally, fraternally? The fact that I have to use two words indicates that we still don't have a single word. Et cetera, et cetera. Why? What is in there is that some humans grabbed power and said, we know better than the rest of you. And we bought into it. And one way through which we are made to buy into it generation after generation is through education, through religion, through politics, through mass media, etc., etc. And I'm not inventing any of your books. Read Antonio Gramsci. Plenty of stuff on that. Okay. Someone once called Gramsci my intellectual parent. I don't know if I would go that far, but that he was someone that I don't necessarily agree with the solutions, but with his analysis of this is all about power and not the power to buy, not the power to produce, the power to convince. Who has the power to convince? Now, that power to convince is not unrelated to other powers, but power to convince is the key. And that's Gramsci. I suggest you read. And by the way, the man after whom your center is named, Dan Romero, and a number of other people would go like this at you.
Thank you. Gracias.
I just heard from them, not knowing that I was going to be meeting you here.
Gracias.
In public, I want to say you're a star in what you do.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Orlando, thank you. I'm already failing miserably in keeping my time. So just to recognize that, I have a few minutes. So I'm going to say thank you very much.